You're listening to Australia, 8:55 AM on International Day of Persons with what they call it disabilities. I don't.
I don't want you at home anymore.
I wanna go to work so I don't have to be poor. I wanna gig with my band on the Portland shore.
Turn up your radio, I got something to say.
You're listening to 3CR on International Day of People with a Disability. Hi, I'm Helen Gwilliam. In the last hour, we spoke to people who are about to start their own journey towards a better life, with the support of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, or NDIS. The NDIS works mainly through individual planning. That means people eligible for NDIS funding write a plan about the equipment and supports they need to live a decent quality of life and achieve their goals. But will more individual planning create the inclusive society that people with disabilities, and hopefully all of us, want and need? I recently attended a forum in Melbourne called Building Inclusive Communities, presented by VALID, the advocacy group for adults with intellectual disability and their families. The forum brought together people with disability, advocates, service providers, researchers and community planners to explore how individual planning and community development could work together to build more inclusive communities. First, Paul Dunn from VALID talks about the purpose of the forums.
We've had three forums and over the course of the last half of the year. We designed them, I suppose, because we thought that there really wasn't much happening in relation to some thinking about community development practice and how it applies to disability. There's a lot of focus on individualised work and individualised planning, but not much really to do with not much of a focus on community planning and how we build communities that include people with disabilities. So we set up three forums. The first one was called Greater Expectations, which is really looking about how we raise expectations about the possibilities for people with disabilities to be included in community life. The second one was about called Creating Community, which was a focus on how we actually plan and work in community to change the structures and systems that often disable people. So how do we actually create enabling communities? Who are the partners we need to engage in that process, and what's some of the work we need to do? And the one we're at today, which is called It Can Happen If, linking individual and community planning, is really focused around all the work that's happening with individuals and the planning conversations that are happening with them through the NDIS and other forums. How do we actually start to find out what it is that people are aspiring to, and how do we use that information to start to link with community planners and community planning and really start to change the way communities think and include people with disabilities in activities and organisations, in mainstream activities and organisations. The way that they're designed, we have a bit of research perspective, we have a lived experience perspective, and we have a practice perspective, so a perspective from a service provider. And it's they really like that format, I think. They're really enjoying the challenge that the researchers are bringing into the forums to get, you know, linking it up to key pieces of research and literature and knowledge that they can use back in their workplaces. And the lived experience, the perspectives from people with disabilities who are engaging with the challenges of, you know, becoming a part of their community is also something that we've received really positive feedback about. So, and then what we've also tried to do, I suppose, is get some quite innovative services and approaches that people can hear about and learn from and again, take back to their own context and see how that can be applied.
Paul Dunn from VALID. The plenary speaker at the Building Inclusive Communities Forum was Dr. Christina David, a research fellow at RMIT University in Melbourne. Christina's research has focused on whether the individualised and market-based approach of the NDIS is undermining the collective voice of people with disability and limiting the opportunities for full citizenship that is their human right.
A premise of individualised funding and the NDIS is that it's about good lives, it's about better lives. But what we know from experience is that in these sorts of systems, or all sorts of social policy reform, there are winners as well as losers. So how can everybody win in this system? Because it's ultimately about citizenship and inclusion. That's the end goal for all of us. We all want to be involved and we all want to be counted as full citizens in our society. So in my work, I do have lots of interactions with advocates and groups and services and not-for-profit organisations, generally civil society. And a lot of the themes over the last few years have been around how advocates and advocacy groups feel that the sector is fragmented. It's very hard to sort of have a collective voice often, that they're rushed, it's very hard to be proactive, and there are issues away around how services and groups are funded, competitive funding, which actually forces competition rather than collaboration. So some of the challenges in the sector that people are saying to us are around, well, how do we maintain a collective voice when everything about the funding structures that we operate in the environment are separating us through sort of competition. So how do we sort of work together, because we know there's power in the collective, and yet this sort of neoliberal government and a lot of funding approaches these days are quite individualistic. At the same time, we all want individual choice, we all want control, and no one's arguing with that. So we're all trying to work out how this happens, how we manage the tensions so that everybody has a good go at having a good life. So the NDIS throws up opportunities and challenges. As we all know, potentially offers unprecedented opportunity for choice and control, individualised budgets and self-management options in an increasingly competitive and marketised sector with a focus on flexibility and personalised programs, is meant to give people more choice and control. It makes sense, and that's something we all want. But at the same time, there are risks and challenges associated with marketisation of human services generally and of disability services in particular. Some of the risks are that marketisation can drive small established players out because they can't compete against big organisations, big businesses. And some commentators say that the profit motive or profit-driven businesses are at odds with the values and purposes of services. Because we want individual choice, but you know, is the market the way to go? And what's the role of the government in sorting this out, and questions around regulation and safeguarding? So they're all really good questions, and we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because the NDIS is something that's been fought for long and hard. So, but it's really about how can everybody do well? How can everybody win? So underlying these tensions are ideas around human rights underpinnings of individualised funding systems like the NDIS, that, you know, ideas around choice and control and inclusion and autonomy, ideas that are very much based in a collective voice. There's an emphasis on both individual choice and autonomy as citizens and the social and structural changes that need to take place for that to happen. On the other side is a citizenship model is firmly based in ideas of collective change and reform, and also gives a lot of power to the community. And there's all, you know, government has a role in structural reform in a citizenship model. So my research, which I did 5 years ago, was looking at the Victorian model of individualised funding, so the ISP program. And I was interested in understanding the reality of everyday lives, like what were people enabled to do by individualised funding? What were the tensions? What were the risks? What were the conditions? And what were the implications for individuals and communities in the NDIS? So I interviewed 5 family carers, 11 adults who had an ISP, 2 ISP planners and facilitators from different regions, 2 support workers, and 7 service workers who are CEOs or senior staff in service providers. because I really wanted to understand from everybody's perspectives what was sort of working, what wasn't. The basic findings, I don't think will come as a surprise to many of you, was that most people were happy with sometimes even just slight increases in choice and flexibility with their everyday services, but many still felt outside the mainstream. Many still felt marginalised. So on a day-to-day basis, things were a bit better because they had the individual budget, but the other stuff wasn't changing. There still weren't the opportunities and the structural and community changes that they needed to sort of have opportunities around work, study, relationship, inclusion. That many people felt that they were still in a holding pattern, and that old choices and ways of thinking were continuing to be reproduced despite the individual package, because things weren't changing fast enough in the community. A key finding was that individuals, family supporters, carers, services were really absorbing the cost of enabling choice and self-determination. So, you know, supporting people navigate the system, advocacy, coordinating services, thinking through all the different options and how to get there, the linking and bridging work that builds social capital in people's lives. And a lot of these really important activities and functions and relationships were often not identified in assessment and planning conversations and not funded. And yet these were critical factors in actually converting people's lives from one thing to something closer to what they wanted. Advantage and disadvantage was produced by the information, knowledge and resource demands of the system. So just engaging with the system exhausted people often. It was often a battle. So people who were good at that stuff, who were good at advocating for themselves and had those resources, tended to do better. But in terms of the enablers of choice and self-determination for people using the ISP, and all the time keep thinking, well, this applies to the NDIS too. This is kind of, think about the implications for the NDIS. We're around, of course, strong social supports and relationships. People who had those strong networks, who had links, established links with the community, were able to make more of their funding package and the services available to them. People really valued having more control and choice in the who, what, how of their services, and service continuity was important for those who really valued a relational approach with services. So being able to have the same support workers day after day and having control over that was a real sort of bonus for many people. Services who could work collaboratively and in a relational way and give opportunities for co-design, and by that I mean that the person and the service worked together to decide what happened each day, that there was a real collaboration there. You know, rosters were sent on time and, you know, like it was a collaborative, it was a different relationship. Access to knowledge and information, as we all know, is incredibly important. This often wasn't the case with people I talked to. Often information was complex and hard to find, inconsistent. But people who could access information in a way, whether it was face-to-face or written or online, was really important. There was a lack of access in the group that I interviewed to advocacy, real, like, sustained advocacy for support making. Some people sort of said they'd never used an advocate, but they clearly needed help in decision making around what they, you know, what would be meaningful for their lives, what would be the best way of sort of what pathways to follow and how to make the most of the resources. Around people who may in those, you know, with ISPs who might have wanted to do the direct employment option, take that up. We're worried about the HR, like, you know, how they manage staff and the financial burden, the administrative burden, so there wasn't enough support around that. A big barrier was around service resistance to change and a culture still of client capture, of people being in the service and services doing everything they could to hold people rather than, you know, opening up opportunities. And, of course, as no one be surprised, deficit-based sort of funding assessment and planning processes focusing what people couldn't do rather than what they could, and there was often inadequate funding and very slow, heavy bureaucracy that people had to fight through to sort of get what they needed. So not surprising to any of you.
Turn up your radio.
You're listening to Christina David, Research Fellow at RMIT University, talking at the recent Valid Building Inclusive Communities Forum about the individualised, market-driven approach to disability services in the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and whether a more collective and collaborative approach would better support the rights of people with disability, their family and advocates.
So a case study which shows again that idea of what is needed to happen to convert all the different capitals and potentials that we have into meaningful lives. Sam, who's 25, attended a day program for 10 years. He told me he really hated it and he felt stuck, but there were no other options because of lack of funding. His mother had applied for an ISP 3 times and was knocked back, but got it eventually, but she described her efforts as a real battle and a fight. He and his mother, but she did get a very significant package in the end, and they worked with trusted providers who they'd known a long time to develop all sorts of new options and opportunities. So Sam ended up studying, writing a book, going to the pub whenever he felt like it to play poker, going away on weekends with a friend and a support worker. So he converted funding that he'd had to use for group camps into these weekends away with friends. And he was feeling great and fulfilled. And so the resource hadn't really changed, but what they were doing with it had changed a lot, and it was grounded in the nature of the relationships that Sam and his mother had with the community and with services. So the challenges and unknowns, basically how, when funding and services are individualised, can collective needs be understood and addressed? How can collective voice be maintained in this climate? Some good services may not survive in a marketised environment, and there might be a level of, you know, social capital and knowledge lost to the sector. And I know a number of services worry that a lot of that unfunded, invisible linking and bridging work they do in community will be lost and won't be able to do it in the NDIS paradigm. And how do we manage the tensions between marketisation and community planning? How do we manage the tension between businesses that are there for profit and our concerns with equity and fairness and inclusion and access? So if building access is expensive and a provider thinks that there's not the population for that, how do we manage that sort of tension? And what is the role of government in this sector? What's the role of government in safeguarding and quality, especially in this new gig economy, which is the online platform where people can just buy services, and it's, you know, very empowering for a lot of people. But how do we also manage that and make it fair for workforce as well as for people using services? Because there are a number of risks as well as opportunities in that. So in terms of some key principles around linking individual and community, a consistent theme in my research was the strongest supports people had were often depleted by the system. So family supports were often, just depleted by lack of funding and overworked and overburdened. So how do we turn that upside down and support and nurture and develop? How do we reimagine the role of services in this space from client land to person land? That's a quote from a service provider. And how do we drive a culture of social innovation in the community? Do through partnerships with and between user groups, with businesses, services and local government to address barriers and open doors. Peer support buddy system, embed those so that, you know, it's really easy for people to access them. It's not just some people, it's everybody can access them, so their choices can be actually informed by information, knowledge and confidence. And finally, in conclusion, the NDIS offers benefits and unprecedented choice, but there are also challenges for maintaining collective voice as accountabilities and responsibilities change. As choice and control is shifted to the individual, so is a level of risk and accountability. And I think a lot of us are still unsure of how that's being managed, how that shift of risk and responsibility is being managed. Good lives are the result of the interplay between the personal, our community, social, cultural, and the policies and the institutional frameworks which govern our actions. And ultimately, good lives are around the linking and bridging which connect people, open communities and build social capital. And I think the challenge in this individualised market climate is to ensure that everyone has a voice, not just some, and that all those voices are heard. Thank you.
Dr. Christina David, at the recent Building Inclusive Communities Forum, presented by Valid, an advocacy group for adults with intellectual disability and their families, based in Fitzroy in Melbourne. The forum was also an opportunity for Valid to unleash its band of intrepid reporters to ask participants what community meant to them and and how their community could be more accessible and inclusive.
Hi, I'm Simone Stevens and I'm a Rebella reporter. Today I'm talking with Michelle Wilcox and I've got a few questions for her. What does the word community mean to you?
Connecting people together.
Where do you hang out in your community?
At my local shopping centre, at my local gym.
And what stops you from getting involved in the community?
Sometimes I have been around transport and being able to go like this.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Tully here, interviewing Marie at the Valid Community Development Forum. And we just have a couple of questions for you, Marie. What does the word community mean to you?
I think I'm still trying to figure that out as a person with a communication impairment. I think of community as being involved with people who live near and doing things in that area. However, I have moved house 3 times and each time I've tried to get to know my neighbors. However, when I bring out my machine, it's like an invisible wall comes up between us and the conversation ends. Any further contact is a friendly wave.
Where do you hang out in your community, Marie?
I use the local shopping centre to do shopping and other appointments.
And here's a good question. What do you do for fun?
I have friends and we go into the city. A central point to meet, to see movies, musicals and go out for dinner. I also have a partner and we do the same thing.
What stops you from getting involved in the community?
As stated before, I think my method of communication prevents neighbors getting to know me. Also, their inaccessible houses prevent me from popping in to chat with them. I work 4 days a week, which limits my activity in the local community. I've just had my support funding review and I've requested a few more hours on the weekend so I can start swimming and exercising at the local gym, which might help me to meet more people.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts on community development, Marie. It was really informative.
Valid reporters Simone Stevens and Tully Zigier talking to Michelle Wilcox and Marie Ireland about what community means to them. Our next speaker from the Building Inclusive Communities Forum was Bill Lawler, a disability advocate and community planner of many years' experience. Bill argued the data within individual NDIS plans needs to be collated and shared with community planners as the collective voice of people with disability to guide more inclusive and accessible community development for everyone. This is Bill Lawler.
Thank you, Paul, thank Valid for inviting me to speak here today to participate in this important forum. What I'd like to do this afternoon is I want to do 3 things. First of all, I wanted to support the strong link between individual planning and community planning. Number 2 was to how can we make it work? And also number 3 is other things that need to happen. So I think it's pretty well recognised now in the disability sector that for people with disabilities to be included, successfully included in the society, and for the NDIS to work, there's a couple of components that need to work together pretty clearly. And obviously, we need individual capacity and community capacity. Now, individual capacity for me is about people with a disability having the skills, knowledge, experience, self-esteem to actually make things happen, to actually articulate their hopes and dreams, and then have the ability to go out into the community to make it happen. We're very, very closely linked to that is the community capacity. Because we can have lots and lots of people with disabilities with incredible individual capacity and knowledge and skills and confidence to go out in the community and do things. But if the community capacity is not there for the community to identify, understand and respond to their needs, well, it's just not going to work. So I think it's a very logical step that there is a strong link, connection and synergy between individual and community planning. Individual planning really is the collective voice of people with disabilities. People with disabilities need to get right involved in community planning, because sitting around in our own groups of people doing our own planning is not going to change communities as quickly as if people with disabilities get out into community planning. And it's also providing a bottom-up grassroots-driven community planning by using the data that's being collected in individual planning processes. Now, when you think about it, if individual and community planning are done effectively, there should actually be a natural link. Because if the planners are listening, really listening to what people with disabilities are saying, then they can identify the things that need to happen for a person to be included in communities. And also, if community planners are really engaging and listening to people with disabilities at the community level, the simpler sorts of information should come out. So I think that if things are done properly, that there will be a natural link between individual and community planning. Now, if we think about community planners, and I was working as a rural access worker for 11 and a half years, and I'm thinking how useful the individual planning data would be. Now, we all, in our practice, we all think about setting themes and priorities for our daily work, because we've got so many competing priorities and so many issues that need to be attended to, that sometimes this data that we could get from individual plans could actually help us set some priorities. Maybe it's employment, maybe it's skills for daily living, maybe it's about people, a large number of people wanting to develop personal relationships which they haven't been able to do in the past. It will also inform our planned projects and partnerships. We need to make choices about which projects and partnerships we do. And having some data or some information about the collective voice of people with disabilities, particularly in local communities, will give us a chance to prioritise our projects and think about the things we really need to work on. As a community development worker, people would come across opportunities all the time. Sometimes things aren't planned. Sometimes you hear about a project or that the council's doing a strategy or somebody is doing something which will have an effect on the community. And sometimes we take up those opportunities and sometimes we don't. And I think the individual planning or the collective voice of people with disabilities can help us identify which opportunities to take up and which opportunities to let go by. I think some qualitative information from planners would be useful. I mean, planners are going to be talking to a lot of people with disabilities and they will get a notion about what's working and what's not working in local communities. And just an example of that was when I was working as a rural access worker, a group of planners and service providers said, people who come to see us want to access Latrobe leisure centres. They're great. You don't have to put much work into them. Go and do something else that's where we're finding barriers. So people can actually identify what's happening by just talking to people. David mentioned earlier about peer support groups. I think they're vitally important. People getting together, talking about their hopes and dreams, talking about things that could happen, is a real resource of information for community planners. And I really like the idea of the clickability, which is the TripAdvisor for disability services. We talk about this disruptive technology. I think we really need to get away from these standards which organisations can pass but still get a lousy service, as David said. I think we need to get people with disabilities telling other people with disabilities about their experiences and what's really working for them. Just another thing I wanted to mention is we mustn't lose sight of the fact that only a small percentage of people with disabilities are going to get packages. I mean, looking at 460,000 people across Australia, and you know, when you think there's probably, depending which way you measure it, maybe five times as many as people have some sort of disability which affects them. So it's really important that we understand that it's likely that people with disabilities want the same things as people without a disability do, and not just planning in isolation. So really what I'm saying is that people with disabilities need to be involved in general community planning, not just specialised community planning about people with disabilities. And we need to encourage and support people with disabilities to get actively involved. Just some examples would be when council's doing their strategic plan, when council's doing their annual community plans, local communities make community plans. These are all places where people with disabilities need to be actively involved. And also in community consultations, people with disabilities need to be supported to be involved in community consultations about their communities, not just about what they think they might need as an individual with a disability. So just in summary, I think that there's probably three different threads which need to come together to ensure that community planning is inclusive of the view of people with disabilities. So general community planning data, including the voice of disabilities. So what I really think needs to happen here is that the collective voice of people with disabilities needs to be heard. And if we can collect that data in some way from the individual plans, that would be a definite advantage. Also, we spoke this morning about really having effective consultation with people with disabilities, really listening to what people want, whether that's at the individual planning level or the community planning level. It's about really listening and not telling people what we think they need, but asking people what they want. So I hope that gives you some insight into in the way that I think things could work, and we hope we can build on that. Thank you very much.
Bill Lawler, speaking at the VALID Building Inclusive Communities Forum in Melbourne, about the importance of community development and local community planning being inclusive of all people with disability.
Turn up your radio, I got something to say. Turn up the radio, turn up the radio. I want a revolution, and I want it today. I want a revolution, I want a revolution.
There were a number of community development workers at the forum. VALID reporter Simone Stevens spoke to Malcolm and Leanne about what community means to them.
Hi, my name is Simone. I'm a VALID reporter. Today we're speaking with Malcolm. What is your role?
Hi, Simone. My name is Malcolm Merritt. I work with the community building program in a role called Metro Access at the Frankston City Council.
What does community mean to you?
Well, community means a lot of things, but basically, to me, it means the people in a certain place, and I think I'm a bit of a word nerd, so community to me means common unity and what brings people together and the similarity that we all have, as opposed to divisive or the opposite, looking at difference, I think can break down a community, but community is about people together in a place.
How do you promote access and inclusion in the community?
Well, it's a very big role, and it's an important role, and it's the focus of our the Metro Access program is to talk to people, to hear the voice of the people, to find out what is express demand, what are gaps in services, and what people want is the first stage in any community development process. The Metro Access role is a community community development framework. So the first thing to develop a community, you've got to understand the community, and it's a focus on access and inclusion. So it's about breaking down barriers to an inclusive society, which is a big job, because I think it crosses the social plane and also the built environment. So my role is very diverse, and the most important part of my role is to listen to the people with disabilities to find out what their needs are and work collaboratively and in partnerships to try and solve some of the gaps in identified gaps.
What do you see as the main barriers to the community inclusion?
There's a lot of barriers, and look, to some people, physical barriers are very prevalent in any environment. Transport is a big expressed barrier to people getting from A to B, is a basic level of barriers. There's also attitudinal and people's attitudes. I think there's a lot of work to be done on being inclusive. Having said that, I think the best way to work through the barriers is to identify them and have conversations and bring people with disabilities into all conversations and all levels of community planning is the best way to approach those barriers.
My name's Leanne Wishart, and my role is as the Rural Access Project Coordinator at Wellington Shire in Gippsland.
What does community mean to you?
Community means lots of things to me. I think as an individual we can belong to lots of communities. It can be the community that we live in, our local neighbourhood. It can be about the town or the suburb that we live in. It can be about the community of people that we share interests with, like arts groups or social groups. And so I think what's really important is that people find the things that interest them, that give them meaning and fulfilment in their lives, and then link up with the communities that they feel support them and that are important to them.
How do you promote access and inclusion in the community?
I do that in a number of ways, I think. In my role, I ask people who live in my community about the issues that come up for them around access and inclusion, and then work on projects that help to break down those barriers. So living in a rural region, there's some really fundamental issues that exist for people, and they're not too different to people that live in the city, except when you live in the country, I'll say public transport ride up. Okay, if you live in the city, accessing public transport can be a bit of a hit and miss affair sometimes, depending on the type of train, the type of tram, the attitude of taxi drivers, access to buses, whether in the country it is whether a train is running, not whether you can get onto a train or not. That then becomes another issue too, about the types of trains that are running on country railway tracks. So one of the really important things that I try and encourage in the community members that I have contact with is to join things like the V-Line Access Group and have a voice for country people, because in the past that might be something that has not been a priority. And so I see my role as community members, particularly people with disability, as leaders, having a voice for the communities in which they live.
Great. Now, thank you very much, Leanne, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Simone. It's been nice meeting you.
Simone Stevens, Valid reporter, talking to rural access worker Leanne Wishart at the Building Inclusive Communities Forum. One of the ways in which people with disability can build their individual and collective voice and exchange ideas with local community planners is through peer action groups. Valid's peer action groups are made up of 5 to 12 people who meet regularly, usually within a local council area or a region, to prepare for and get the most out of the NDIS. While the groups help members to improve their individual plans and activities, the networks also enable systemic barriers in the local community to be identified and hopefully addressed. Valid reporter Luke Nelson spoke to 2 peer action facilitators about their groups.
Luke Nelson, Valid reporter. Today I'm speaking with Michelle Wilcox. Where is your group based?
My group is based in Hayden, and we meet at Hayden Project Help and Community Centre.
That's fantastic. So what does this project and group mean to you?
It's really all about giving people with disability the opportunity to become ready for the national disability insurance scheme.
That's very important. And what programs are you working on at the moment? What projects is your group focusing on?
We're focusing on self-management. It's really all about getting group members to a stage where they can take over their own leadership of the group.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much, Michelle. Hi, Eve. How are you?
Hi, Luke. How are you? I'm good. I'm good. Thanks.
So where is your group based?
We're based in Whittlesea. Yeah, northeast.
Okay, that's great. What is your group working on at the moment?
Okay, we're finding our feet, but we've got quite a bit on the agenda, or at least I have quite a bit on the agenda for next year. We want to enlarge the group. We also want to create some groups that will, integrate into the community.
That's fantastic. And what does the word community mean to you?
The word community means everybody of all nations, of all capacity, of all indifferences, working and living together as one.
Luke Nelson, Valid Reporter, talking to Michelle Wilcox and Eve Werner about their peer action groups. Our final speaker from the Valid Building Inclusive Communities Forum is Jenny McPherson, also a peer action facilitator. Jenny's story is extraordinary. In a time when people with disability had much less choice and agency, Jenny ran away from home and became homeless to gain her independence, and lived for many years without the disability supports that are now available. Jenny has fought hard for her independence, in many ways, but as we'll hear, she's found that independence can be lonely, and perhaps there is a better path, where people with disability are treated as full citizens, participating in and being supported by their communities. Jenny spoke to the forum in conversation with her longtime friend, David Craig.
I'm here because Jenny and I have known each other for, I hate to tell you, she doesn't look this old, but probably about 35 years. And I don't know, when I was a recreation worker, and there was around about 50, 60 teenagers at a special school in Glenmobley that I was responsible for, along with some adults in other areas. And my job was to, through recreation, create opportunities for those guys to get out there and have a life and find the things they like doing in the community. But there was something about Jenny that drew me to her. She had a great deal of spirit, and I never forgot that, that she stood out a little bit that way, special. And I suppose her story today will highlight, some of that spirit and spunk and some of the things that crushed it at times, and then perhaps some of the things that revived it again. And we're trying to track a little story that starts off with a struggle for independence, or an escape from dependence towards independence, and then discovering the power and the importance of interdependence. And we hope we capture that in the story. So, Jen, I'd like you to share your earliest memories of your struggle to escape from a dependent relationship and become an independent person.
I ran away from home, quite literally, and I was homeless for probably about 2.5 years, and I slept in many different places, and one of those places was, there was a man who used to come in and clean the school at 6 a.m, and I slept in a school for about 2 weeks in the local, had a little OT bedroom, and I decided I couldn't be bothered making a bed. So I slept under the bed and put all my stuff in the back of the wardrobe where no one would see it, and just left it there during the day. And then I decided, in order to shower, that I would shower after the first swimming session of, because we had a pool there for physiotherapy, and I decided that I would shower after that first swim session so that no one could see the floor. So yeah, I just had to find, because I was a bit ashamed of being homeless, so I didn't want people to know. So I thought, what can I do to be clean and healthy and have my independence away from home? I didn't want to be at home.
So you did try a residential care facility. What was that like?
Very impersonal. I tried a number of them, and they just didn't fit my needs. They didn't understand what I needed, and it was like I wasn't getting enough sleep, so I became very unwell. I had seizures. I had to fit into what was there, and for as long as I can remember, I've always wanted something better, and that's been in all areas of my life. Thanks to David here, he helped me negotiate my way into the local integration program at the high school, and I completed years 10 and 11. I completed subjects like English and history, and I learned such a lot out there. While I was at that school, I had off study and was living away from home, but it was there that I really began to develop my social skills and interact with peers in a real strong way. And I learnt lots of things. I learnt that people can be cruel and people can be very supportive. And I just learnt that you've got to roll with the punches. From the time I grew up, my generation was taught, you must be independent, you must do it by yourself, no matter what. Now, for the average person, that's not how it works. You're taught to share and play together in the playground and help each other out. We weren't taught that. And so, for me, when I left home by myself and I saw myself as independent, I thought, I've achieved my goal, I've done what I set out to do. And then I realised that it's lonely being independent. I had to go through that process in order to work out what interdependence was, to become a citizen, not just a member of the community. They're different. They're really, really different. It doesn't matter how much money we're given, the community isn't quite there to see us as participating citizens. And that's what needs to change.
Jenny McPherson and David Craig. David has had a long career as a disability advocate and activist. I spoke to him after his and Jenny's conversation about the importance of maintaining a focus on community action for empowerment of people with disability as the NDIS is rolled out nationally.
I suppose the NDIS has captured a lot of people's attention because it's probably one of the biggest reforms in our society, not just in disability space, but in society after Medicare. And our concerns are that, you know, there's such a focus on the funding supports and packages and equipment. But at the end of the day, the funding supports are needed and necessary for people to be able to do the things that ordinary people do. But in order for people to pursue goals and the dreams and their aspirations that other people have, much more is needed. People need to have strength and capacity, but individuals, as we've heard from today, are really struggling to achieve anything on their own. And working together in collective ways, you know, through peer support groups, through community action groups or working groups, people are feeling like they're being empowered and strengthened to do things. So the forums here are about really trying to reclaim this idea that community is important, that communities are really healthy and do well when everyone is participating and contributing. And we know that even with an NDIS package, people may even become overfunded and still not contribute a lot. You know, they'll go out and they'll do things. They'll have activities and they'll do a life, but it may not have a great deal of meaning. It may not be inspiring. It may not be something that really uses their full capacity. Now, people are sort of people with disabilities have lived in a community that has existed for a long time without them present, and has been designed, developed, and evolved with people with disabilities on the margins or in a separate stream of life through day centres and sheltered workshops and special schools and institutional living arrangements. So these forums are really trying to, I suppose, awaken again a consciousness and an understanding of how important it is that we as citizens need to act. We can't just rely on governments to build community. You know, that it is communities that are the people in community, citizens coming together, that make community strong and that probably make communities the kind of place that people be able to have the kind of lives that they're aspiring to.
Earlier on today, you were talking about the, I suppose, the market approach of the NDIS, creating the risk that people would, in some ways, become more isolated and siloed. How concerned are you about that happening?
Well, as someone that has worked now nearly 40 years in the sector, and my work in recreation was really around giving people a life in the community where choice, control, freedom, enjoyment, fun, adventure, relationship, belonging are all the kinds of outcomes we are working towards. It's been clear to me that all the systems governments have put in place to try and drive service providers towards using standards and quality frameworks and all these things to encourage them to address those outcomes, we have continued to fail. And that there are other drivers in the service system that have probably been driving things in a different way than what people with disabilities were looking for themselves. So I came to the view some time back that, probably maybe 20 years ago, that unless people actually had the funding in their own hands, you know, if everyone had an amount of funding that enabled them the necessary and reasonable supports they need to get on with their life, and not too much, and that's a big question, how much is enough, but if they had that and they were able to determine how the money was used to meet their goals and needs, that would make a huge difference. Now, that's a necessary... that drives you necessarily towards a marketplace and a market space. But I've also believed that, you know, you need mitigating influences and forces to prevent the... both allow the positive aspects of a marketplace to work well, but the where there are deficits in the marketplace, that there are mediating structures and supports that communities lead and drive and hopefully governments still invest in but don't prescribe, that allow people to become strong, to actually aspire to use less resources if they can, in order, you know, by becoming more involved, more empowered, more capable. And there's nothing about our current system that allows that. The current system, pre-market, was funded around a unit cost that actually prevents and disincentivizes supporting people towards independence and self-reliance.
I was very struck by something that Jenny said about growing up in an era, and I recognise this in myself, where the goal was independence, and that leads you towards really doing your own thing. How do we, as people with disability, become... Where do we go to get more literate in community ourselves and in creating the community that we want?
Well, you know, it's a sad reflection in my experience that, you know, so many of the services that articulate the messages of community inclusion and participation in their rhetoric, in their mission statements, their vision statements, they do little other than pay funded professionals to provide supports. And those people themselves, in their own lives, probably do very little. And I think until we are the community we want there to be, we're not going to get it. So, you know, we actually have to learn to be community to people with disabilities. We need to think about, in our own private lives outside our paid and professional responsibilities, what have we done to ensure that the groups that we belong to, the activities we do, the places we visit, are places that would be welcoming and accessible and supportive of people who bring all kinds of diversity.
David Craig from Valid, ending our show from the Building Inclusive Communities Forum held in Melbourne in November 2016, with a message for all of us to practice inclusion, to build the communities that we want to live in. Thanks to everyone at Valid for their assistance with this show, especially Paul, John, Tully, Luke, Simone, David and Michelle. If you'd like more information about Valid and their peer support groups, go to their website, valid.org.au. I'm Helen Gwilliam. Thanks for listening. Stay with us now on 8:55 a.m. for the rest of 3CR's all-day broadcast for International Day of People with Disability, where we access all areas. Up next, Liz Wright with Are You Looking at Me?
give me an attitude of positivity.
I don't want you at home anymore.
I wanna go to work so I don't have to be poor. I wanna gig with my band on the Portland shore.
Turn up your radio, I got something to say. Turn up the radio, turn up the radio. I want a revolution, and I want it today. I want a revolution, I want a revolution. I
wanna play pool at the pub every Friday night.
Connect me to the internet, the world will be mine.
I wanna be free, is that a crime?
Turn up your radio, I got something to say.
Jog in the city air. I met a woman in a wheelchair. Said, I'm sorry to see your handicap. She says, what makes you think a thing like that? And she looks at me real steady. And she says, you want to drag? So she starts to roll and I start to run. And she beat the pants off my aching buns. You know, going uphill I'd hit my stride. But coming down she'd sail on by. When I finally caught up with her, she says, not bad for somebody able-bodied. You know, with adequate care and supervision, you could be taught simple tasks. So how about something to eat? I said that it'd suit me fine. We're near a favorite place of mine. So we moseyed on over there. But the only way in was up a flight of stairs. Gee, I never noticed that, says I. No problem, the maitre d' replies. There's a service elevator around the back. So we made it upstairs on the elevator with the garbage, flies, and last week's potatoes. I set it like a table for my friend and me. He says, I'll try to find one out of the way. And he whispers, she gonna be sick? I mean, pee on the floor or throw some kind of fit? I said, no, I don't think so. I think she once had polio. That was 20 years ago. See, the fact of the matter is, if the truth be told, she can't walk. So he points to a table, she wheels her chair. Some people look down and others stare. And a mother grabs her little girl, says, keep away, honey, that woman's ill. We felt right welcome. Then a fellow walks up and starts to babble about the devil, and the Holy Bible says, woman, though marked with flesh's sin, pray to Jesus, you'll walk again. Then the waiter says, what can I get for you? I said, I'll have your best imported brew. And he says, what about her? I said, who? He says, her. Oh, you mean my friend here? He says, yeah. I say, what about her? Well, what does she want? Why don't you ask her? And he apologizes. Says he never waited on a cripple before. So she talks to the manager when we're through. She says there's some things you could do to make it easier for folks in wheelchairs. He says, oh, it's not necessary. Handicap never come here anyway. Well, I said goodnight to my newfound friend. I said, I'm beginning to understand a little bit of how it feels to roll through life on a set of wheels. She says, don't feel sorry, don't feel sad. I take the good along with the bad. I was arrested once at a protest demo, and the police had to let me go. See, we were protesting the fact that public buildings weren't wheelchair accessible. Turned out the jail was the same way. Anyway, I look at it this way. In 50 years, you'll be in worse shape than I am now. See, we're all the same, this human race. Some of us are called disabled. And the rest, well, the rest of you are just temporarily able-bodied.
Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia, on the Kulin Nation. For more information and to find out how you can support 3CR, go to www.3cr.org.au.